the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, bacteria in your gut tweak your brain, sometimes friendly, sometimes not.
The gut bacteria can determine to a great degree how we feel, whether we are sad or happy, whether we perceive pain or not. The bacteria can not only modify the behavior, but actually change brain chemistry.
The 100-day genocide in Rwanda, recalling the mayhem on its 29th anniversary.
Today, many journalists in Rwanda seem to be haunted by the spirit of El Terem. If you just go on the microphone, you are always very cautious. What am I saying? Won't people misinterpret what I'm saying?
And armed drones. Canada wants to buy some.
We haven't had an open discussion or debate in Canada that we've seen in other places regarding the acquiring of armed drones. Drones being used for surveillance of protests domestically, right? Which are, you know, very problematic uses of these platforms, impacts on our human rights.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are what you eat, so they say. As it happens, the trillions of bacteria inhabiting your gut eat what you eat and turn meals into molecules that affect your mind, for better or worse. Premisl Birchik studies the interaction. Birchik is an associate professor of gastroenterology at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. That is where I reached him. This gut microbiome, these bacteria in our gut, they affect our mind, don't they? They have an impact on our brain. And conversely, our nervous system has an impact on them.
You are absolutely right. So there are many studies, not only from animal experiments, but also now we have some studies in humans which suggest that the gut bacteria can determine to a great degree how we feel, whether we are sad or happy, whether we perceive pain or not. So they play probably a significant role in the gut function, but also they can affect the distant organs such as the brain.
How do they do that?
So there are probably multiple ways how the gut bacteria can communicate with the brain. The first one would be through the immune system. And we know that the gut bacteria modulate and shape our immune system. So they can induce production of pro-inflammatory mediators, cytokines, and this can change our behavior. The bacteria can also, through their metabolic activity, produce many molecules which can directly interact with our neural system. And they can actually produce the typical neurotransmitters like serotonin or histamine. And the last way how they communicate is directly interacting with the nervous system. And in that case, the vagus nerve, which is the main nerve which supplies the gastrointestinal tract, can be stimulated by the bacteria. It senses actually what kind of bacteria we have in our bowels. And some of the beneficial effects of probiotics, there were studies in both animal and humans, show that the beneficial effect of probiotic actually exerts or is exerted through the vagus.
So you're saying the vagus nerve, those nerve endings, actually recognize specific bacteria?
Maybe not specific bacteria, but they recognize a threat. And these were already studies done more than 15 years ago, showing that when animals are colonized with pathogens, so the bacteria which can induce infection, the brain or the neural system can perceive them already within several hours. And this is before any significant immune reaction is detected. Basically, the neural system probably is scanning what we have in our bowels.
That's amazing. People who are experiencing stress, emotional stress, affects your microbiome. Talk about that.
Yes, and this goes to the fact that this communication between the gut bacteria and the brain, it's a bidirectional flow of information. And again, starting with animal studies, it has been shown that both acute and chronic stress can change composition of gut microbiome. So that means proportion of different strains. And even more interestingly, the stress reaction can change activity of some bacteria. And this is probably through the autonomous nervous system and through the adrenergic signaling. So we know even the pathways which are involved in this communication.
Tell me about these experiments you've carried out, taking bacteria from the gut of people who are suffering from inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, or irritable bowel syndrome, and taking these and putting them into the gastrointestinal tracts of germ-free mice, mice that have no bacteria in their intestines, and seeing what happened. Can you talk about this?
Sure. So there, these experiments were actually performed to investigate whether the gut bacteria have any causal role in these chronic gastrointestinal diseases, as you already mentioned. And we mainly focused on irritable bowel syndrome, which is very common, affects probably 10% of population globally. And it's manifested by chronic abdominal pain and abnormal bowel habits. And the study which we performed, and it was already published in 2017, demonstrated that if you use the stool samples or stool microbiome of patients with irritable bowel syndrome, colonizing germ-free mice with their bacteria can change the bowel habits of the mice. It can also induce low-grade gut inflammation. And interestingly, because many patients with irritable bowel syndrome will have also some psychiatric comorbidities like anxiety and depression, we also showed in that study that mice that were colonized with gut bacteria from patients with comorbid or concurrent anxiety also developed anxiety-like behavior. So in a way, just by transplanting the gut bacteria from patients into mice, we transferred also the phenotype of the disease.
Some bacteria are, if I may use the word good, they're, you know, good bacteria in terms of what they, their influence on the brain, apparently. And there's some that are not good, they're bad. And in the first category, we've got Bifidobacterium longum. And in the other, the second one, Klebsiella aeruginase. Can you talk about these two bacteria?
Definitely.
Talk about Bifidobacterium longum.
Bifidobacterium longum belongs to this classical probiotic, so bacteria which we think that they have beneficial effect on the host. And this specific bacterium you are referring to is has a specific name, Bifidobacterium longum NCC3001, and it's a specific isolate which were provided to us by Nestle. And we studied this probiotic in many ways, and we studied them in animal models. And interestingly, this probiotic was managed to normalize anxiety-like behavior, which was induced by low-grade inflammation in mice. And because it was the results were so consistent across several animal models, we then designed a pilot clinical study in patients with irritable bowel syndrome and anxiety or depression. And again, that study was already published several years ago. And it showed that a six-week treatment with this probiotic decreases depression scores in these patients. It also improves their gut symptoms. And very interestingly, because we did also some brain imaging using magnetic resonance imaging, this probiotic bacterium changed the neural activity in several areas of the brain, which are usually targeted by antidepressants. So very interesting, very intriguing data. And just for curiosity, we have just initiated a big validation study in Canada, in multiple sites, where we want to confirm these results in a big multi-center study. Bifidobacteria and lactobacilli, these are the most common probiotics, and you can find them in multiple forms and shapes in health stores or in pharmacies. Bifidobacterium longum has been used as probiotic for a long time, and we have actually tested multiple strains, because it's not only the general Bifidobacterium longum, but you have to go really, you have to identify the specific strain. And we tested several of them, and from, if I remember, 8 or 9, only one had this very specific effect on the behavior and on the brain.
Okay, so now what's it producing? What's this strain producing that has a good effect on our head?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I would love to know, and we did many experiments trying to address that specific question. The clinical study, the pilot one, which we did several years ago, suggested that there is one metabolite which may affect conversion of dopamine to noradrenaline. And these are the two neurotransmitters which are involved in depression. So this may be one of the mechanisms. I hope that this bigger study will provide more clues.
Huh. And when we spoke back in 2015, you were talking about brain-derived neurotrophic factor being expressed during probiotic treatment. Can you talk about that? Can you update this?
So, yes, then that specific Bifidobacterium longum upregulated this neurotrophin, brain-derived neurotrophic factor in the area of hippocampus. And we think that this is the one mechanism how this probiotic works. Unfortunately, it's almost impossible to prove that this happens in humans because of the way how to visualize it, right? It's much easier in animal models. BDNF is one of the markers of neural activity or marker which is used to document changes in the neurochemistry, in the brain chemistry, with respect to the anxiety or depressive-like behaviors. And it has been also shown that it's, for example, decreased in patients with depression or anxiety.
It decreases?
Right.
In people with depression and anxiety?
Right. And the probiotic we are speaking about was able to upregulate it, at least in a mouse model.
In the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is associated with, it's part of the limbic system, isn't it? It's associated with emotional response.
That's correct. And the hippocampus and the amygdala are probably the two main brain regions that we assess when studying these behavior changes in mice, but also in humans. And again, going back to our pilot clinical study, when we went doing this magnetic resonance imaging, our primary region of interest was amygdala. And we found that this probiotic decreased activity in that specific region. And again, this goes very well with decreased depressive score. So I think it's very, very interesting that we can show that the bacteria can not only modify the behavior, but actually change brain chemistry. And there are other groups which demonstrated had similar findings, whether in humans or using the imaging or in mice.
Tell me about Klebsiella aerogenes and histamine.
So this is a slightly different story, and this is more about the bad bacteria, as you said. Probably you know many patients report that their specific gut symptoms worsen after ingestion of specific foods. And one of the diets which is now being widely recommended is low FODMAP diet. So basically diet low in fermentable fiber. And the study which was done at Queen's University found that when you put the patients with the IBS on low fermentable diet, a significant proportion of them will decrease their symptoms. And interestingly, this is paralleled by decrease in urinary histamine. So histamine, it's a neuroimmune mediator. It has been previously linked to irritable bowel syndrome. And a simple explanation would be that we have in some way modified activity of mast cells, because these are the immune cells located in the gut, which mainly produce histamine. But we asked, is there an alternative explanation for that? And we were already speaking about bacteria being able to produce the neuroimmune mediators that humans possess. So the question was, could it be that with this low fermentable diet, we are altering production of histamine by bacteria? And again, this it has been already demonstrated many years ago that some bacteria can produce histamine. This happens, for example, during production of wine or cheese. It can also happen during spoilage of food. For example, food poisoning with tuna and production of histamine has been described on many occasions.
And histamine is an inflammatory neuromediator.
That's correct. So it's a mediator which induces inflammation, but it's also a mediator directly involved in pain. And in the study that we were working on, we again use the same model I already described earlier, when we use germ-free mice and colonize them with gut bacteria from patients. And in this specific instance, we used stool samples or stool microbiota from patients who had very high urinary histamine, complemented it with another patient who had low urinary histamine as well as healthy control. And then we studied the effect of these specific microbial sets in bacteria. And long story short, we found that the gut microbiome can produce large amounts of histamine. And we identify this specific bacterium, Klebsiella aerogenes, who is a histamine superproducer. And we identify multiple bacteria that are able to produce histamine. However, this Klebsiella is producing probably 100 times more than any other strain. And this is probably due to the very specific enzyme that these bacteria have. And they convert one of the amino acids, which is usually present in proteins, histidine, into histamine. So now what we think, what is happening, that if you have this bacterium in your bowels and you also consume high fermentable diet, in that case that the bacteria start producing high amount of histamine, this histamine crosses intestinal barrier. And because it's a chemoattractant, it brings mast cells in the gut. And these mast cells get activated and secrete even more histamine and other mediators which directly induce in pain. So here we have a direct mechanism by which bacteria or a specific bacterium can trigger pain and symptoms in patients.
But I've spoken with folks talking about the use of high fermentable diet, certain types of highly fermentable oligo sugars and things in improving mood. Don't some folks say, you know, you should eat more fermentable fiber? That helps your gut microbiome. It boosts your mood to eat more fermentable fiber, but certain types of fermentable fibers.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. So first, fermentable fiber, it's a very heterogeneous group, right? And you have multiple types of fiber. And you have to take also into account the gut bacteria. So gut bacteria are very heterogeneous. Each of us will have a very specific and unique profile, and it will be determined by our genetic background, the bacteria which we inherited from our mothers, the transfer during the birth. And then another factor is this long-term diet. So there will be probably additional factors Overall, we think that high fermentable diet, or which is usually in fruits and vegetables, is beneficial. But there will be some individuals who cannot handle this, especially complex fibers, which are not digested by our enzymes, but get to the large bowel. And this is where they serve as food for colonic bacteria. And because it's an excellent food source for them, they will produce many metabolites, which may have negative effect on our health, but also produce lots of gas. And this is where the bloating, which usually patients experience, is probably coming from. So I think that we shouldn't generalize that for everybody the high fiber is good or is bad, but we have to understand the interaction between the fiber and the specific microbiome, and also the context in which it's happening. So in healthy individuals, if you eat, for example, legumes, everybody will perceive some distension after eating a big portion of legume. But in healthy individuals, it will be just a distension which is not accompanied by pain. However, in patients where already the gut is more sensitive, it will trigger pain and discomfort.
What amazes you the most about what you've learned over the course of the last 10, 15, 20 years? What do you think is the most interesting? Or the least expected, the most surprising.
It's so complicated. It's the more and more I learn about the interactions between the diet and the microbiome, more difficult it becomes. You know, and it's not only looking what bacteria we have in our bowels, but what these bacteria are doing. And we are speaking about thousands, maybe 10,000s of metabolites, which can affect the immune system, the gut, or the neural system. And we have to really understand what these molecules are doing. And probably maybe if we speak again in 10 years, we will have already some individualized approaches to patients. So when they come to the clinic, we will be able to profile their microbiome. We will be able to analyze their diets. And together with the genetic information of that specific patient, we will be able to provide better diagnosis and better treatments.
Premek Birchik, thank you so much for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Premisl Birchik is an associate professor in the Division of Gastroenterology and director of the Clinical Motility Lab at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Premik's research focuses on bowel disorders such as celiac disease and the mysterious links between gut bacteria, bowel inflammation, and your state of mind. Read more about Premik's research at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. If what you're hearing is going down well, go to greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. The 9th anniversary of Rwanda's 1994 genocide has just come to a close. Over the course of those awful 100 days between April 7th and July 15th, 1994, an estimated 800,000 ethnic Tutsis and a lesser number of their Hutu neighbors were brutally killed by Hutu extremists armed with knives, hoes, and machetes. Over the airwaves, venom flowed. Announcers at Radio Mille Collines, RTLM, urging listeners to kill the cockroaches. RTLM had been set up to create harmonious development in Rwandan society. Instead, they handed out cheap pocket radios to people on the street to stoke the furnace of ethnic hatred and mass murder. Rwandan radio has come a long way since then. Walking into the studios of Radio Rwanda in bustling Kigali, visiting station manager Willie Rukundo. Back in the early 90s, before the genocide, Radio Rwanda dominated the airwaves, state-controlled, serious. Then, one of Radio Rwanda's technicians and some powerful friends set up a station of their own, RTLM, Radio Free Mille Collines. Hate radio was born, the sharpest weapon in the 100-day bloodbath that followed, next to the axe and machete, spreading lies, inciting murder. When the mayhem ended, RTLM vanished, but Rwandan radio had been transformed. Today, the ghosts of hate radio haunt these halls.
Today, many journalists in Rwanda seem to be haunted by the spirit of LTRM. If you just go on the microphone, you are always very cautious. What am I saying? Won't people misinterpret what I'm saying? And that is the spirit of LTRM that is haunting today's Rwandan journalists, especially radio journalists. So today we are using the same instrument to heal the wounds that this radio station participated in inflicting on our people.
The ghosts of genocide are here too, wandering the campus of Rwanda's National University. In the lovely university arboretum nearby, the bodies of students and professors lie in shallow graves. In the classroom of a charming building designed by a priest from Quebec named Levesque, students study the role of radio in the 1994 genocide and the importance of ethical journalism today. But when young announcers sit behind a mic at one of Rwanda's new commercial stations, their aim is to entertain, not exorcise ghosts.
Good evening, everybody. This is Double D, and you're back here with Domino in the studio on this beautiful Saturday evening. This female has decided to select some of the best tracks in town for you to take you on this Saturday night. I'm going to play you a track, reggae artist. They're called Inner Circle, and the song is called Girl, I Want to Make You Sweat. Let's hope this is what the music will do to you tonight. Otherwise, stay tuned, and we'll be right back. I've been watching you.
Okay, my name is Sylvia Gasana. I'm 23 years old. What got me into radio? I was looking for employment, and all these new private radio stations were coming up in Rwanda. And somebody said to me, you know, you're bilingual, why don't you give it a shot? At our station, we try to not talk too much about the genocide. Anything you're going to use to promote anything, first of all, you've got to make it appealing to the public. Something attractive to them, something that they want to listen to.
Then there's Radio Izuba, Rwanda's first community broadcaster. Based in the eastern town of Kibungo, Izuba wants to do more than just entertain. It wants to promote truth-telling, reconciliation, good governance, and development. There's a prison next door to Radio Izuba. Behind its red brick walls, a chorus of voices rises. Many of these prisoners are locked up on genocide charges. Within earshot of their songs, Izuba station manager Clement Kirenga tells a visiting Canadian journalist about Radio Izuba listener clubs and village reporters who help gather news.
They collect news from the community, bring it to us, we broadcast it, and then they go back to the community, ask them, how did you conceive the programs of Radio Izuba? How would you like them changed in order for the radio to suit, to broadcast programs that suit their ideas, that reflect their ideas down there.
Are they journalists?
They are local journalists, as I can say. They are not journalists according to the law, but because they don't have all that paper qualifications, but they are just there. We've trained them. We've given them 3 rounds of training to know the basic principles of collecting news. We've trained them on how...
Where are we going, Clément? Where are we going?
We are going to Mirenge.
the Red District of Mirenge, Chibungo Province. We are visiting some members of listeners clubs working with the Radio Izuba. They work as local reporters. It's a very important aspect